Hey guys, before today's episode, I just wanted to let you know that things continue to buzz over at the Intensive Care Academy, our other project, a video-based platform where you can get a lot of additional critical care education, lots of videos, a couple of additional podcast feeds, and more. We just dropped a procedural video on inserting IO lines, and next up is going to be abdominal transplant for the SICU. Check it out if you haven't. Continuing education credits are available too. ICU101.com. That's ICU101.com. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative, storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you, and as always, joining me is Brandon Odo.
Hello.
It's just us today. We thought we would talk about some stuff that really we've kind of talked about a lot of these things because they're basic ICU things, but we're going to do it with a little bit of a twist. Those of us who work in the ICU, whether you have an official role as a rapid response person or not, I'm sure we've all dealt with the call from the floor service that says, I need some help. In our case, it's usually some intern who's alone and is uncomfortable and just calls and says, hey, can I just get a second set of eyes on someone? But sometimes it may be a legit emergency. Somebody calls and says, listen, I've got a patient who's not doing well, and I think they need to come to the ICU. And all of that, operating outside of the ICU, operating without your normal team, brings its own unique challenges. So we thought we would kind of talk about that and how that all works and how to make the best of it. So I thought we'd start with, I'd give Brandon a case, and we'll just sort of walk through kind of how things go when you're dealing with, and it's usually an emergency, right? It's not always. Sometimes, like I said, it's just a, hey, I've got this patient and I'm uncomfortable. Can you come look? But oftentimes it's at least a quasi-emergency outside of the ICU. So,
yeah, Brandon, people's role in these will, of course, depend on where you are. I would say in general, at smaller centers, it's more likely that the ICU clinicians will be primarily responsible for rapid responses. And, you know, codes, cardiac arrests, can kind of be lumped in here. But larger centers, it's more likely there's some kind of dedicated team for these. It's just too busy because there's so many of them. But smaller places, because it is sort of a sporadic event, it's more likely that these teams are pulled from other places. And many times that may not exclusively include, but will include the ICU folks. So most places I've worked, I've been responsible for going to rapid responses and also cardiac arrests. So it's definitely can be an important, you know, skill set for ICU folks. But like you said, even if you are not technically part of these teams, you will find yourself outside your home seeing sick patients at times.
Yeah. Even if it's, I mean, I had one day where I was literally just walking to my office outside of the SICU. I think I was getting ready to go get some lunch and heard an alarm from down the hall and people running. And I was like, yikes, man, should I go down there? People are running. And I walked down and found, yeah, some poor hospitalist who didn't really know what to do with this patient who was not coding, but headed that way real fast. And so, yeah, sometimes you just stumble upon them, right? But like you said, everybody's going to run into this at some point. A lot of places have a dedicated rapid response team that's run by nurses without providers, and they use a lot of protocols and things like that. And I find that those can vary widely. You know, sometimes you'll have really good nurses with really good protocols, and they can like head off a lot of stuff. You know, like I have a patient who's, you know, having some pulmonary edema, and we put them on BiPAP and give them some Lasix and they get better, and that's that. And the other places, like you said, they're just too busy. And basically what they're going to do is they're going to transport a patient to the ICU. Okay. So let's do a kind of a basic, I think, case like this, right? For most folks, A good example is a respiratory distress, right? We just mentioned sort of putting people on CPAP, pulmonary edema, et cetera. But let's say you get called to the bedside of a patient who's on the floor. And this is a 65-year-old gentleman who was admitted with some acute kidney injury and a little bit of heart failure exacerbation. You don't know much about him. You get this call that he's requiring increased oxygen, has increased oxygen requirements, and is now up to 6 liters nasal cannula, and his SATs are sort of mid to high 80s.
So, you know, I want to try to lay out sort of the things that the ideal form of how you would probably handle these sorts of calls, but also I want to give a somewhat realistic sense for how they often tend to actually go, because the real life is often different than the ideal, and just because these are inherently sort of generally more chaotic events. So if you can make your rapid responses, just like codes or most acute emergencies, if you can make them look like a textbook, you're operating at a really high level. Because a lot of the gap is not necessarily not knowing good theory, it's implementing it in these more chaotic environments. So like I'll say that that's already a lot more information than you'll often have. You know, many times you get a rapid response call, you may not have any information, even like why it's called. All you know is the room number. Sometimes if I'm at a computer, I'll take 10 seconds, try to pull up the room and just give a quick skim just to see who's this person, you know, maybe why are they in the hospital, who's the primary team? That's sometimes worth knowing. So if you need to close a loop on that. And if I can get a quick eyeball at like some basic info like recent vitals, maybe is there a baseline echo or just like some of those things. But, you know, this is in a matter of a few seconds. So in short of that, what you're doing is walking into the room and getting the data of just your eyeballs and then trying to get some kind of information. So the ideal way to turn up at these things, and there's probably, let me first say, walk, don't run. There is someone there. If someone is dying in seconds, they can do CPR. Your role is not to be that person. It's to turn up a few seconds later, but be well oxygenated and thoughtful. So turn up like the guy with the answers, not the guy with the problem. Walk in the room and ideally identify yourself. A lot of people just roll up in these things. Many times there are many responders, both people who are supposed to and also just people who turn up to be helpful or they're bored or whatever. So it's nice for everyone to know who you are. That's nice by name, but more importantly by role. So you know, walk in the room and say, you know, I'm Brandon, or even just, you know, ICU is here, ICU, PA, something like that. And then trying to fairly rapidly establish some kind of coherent communications. So a smart way to go is to ask who's in charge or who's running this. And if typically that is you, if your role is to run the rapid responses, then maybe you'll assume that is you. But then I would ask, who's the primary nurse? Because in most cases, that's who called. And if I want to figure out what is going on that most basic level, why are we here? Then that's who's probably going to tell me. So, you know, who is the primary nurse? And then someone says, oh, it's me. And then, you know, ask, what's going on? Or why did you call? And so it sounds like in this case, it's an increased oxygen requirement. So then it's a matter of getting other basic from the door data. So, you know, look around. What are we looking at? I assume there's a person in a bed. What's that person look like?
Yeah, and I will say that you're exactly right. What the scene, so to speak, when you show up varies widely. And if you're in a place where this is like if there's a system in place, like you said, like a nurse called a rapid response, then you're probably going to show up and there's people there doing stuff. I've gotten these kind of calls before from, again, like I said, an intern on the floor service who says, I'm concerned. Can you come look at this patient and help me out? And I get there and there's no one there because, you know, the nurse has four other patients and she's down the hall And no one's really alerted her that there's concern, right? The intern just happened to walk by and said, oh my God, Mr. Johnson doesn't look so good. And then sometimes he's like, well, great. I called the ICU team. So I'm moving on to my other 30 patients. And so you get there and there's no one there. But in this case, you do show up and there's people there. There's a nurse, there's a respiratory therapist, and there's nobody from the primary team because they've called, the nurses have called you instead.
Yeah. And, you know, if primary teams turn up, it's in most cases because they hear about the rapid and are like, hey, that's our patient. It's not necessarily, right, like, they're not right. necessarily part of the rapid response team. So they may be later. And I'll say, you know, many places have actually now allowed or even encouraged non-staff to call rapid responses or, you know, medical emergency teams. So like family members,
yeah.
if they have a concern, there may be like signs and stuff that say you can call that. And I mean, I think probably that makes us a little leery on some level, but you know, if someone is concerned, you call this number is the idea. So if when in doubt, your question is who called this and why, because that's why you're here.
Yeah. And your point about asking the question is a good one, because I've gone to these before where I come in and, who called the respiratory therapist, right? They came by to give the patient a breathing treatment and found them breathing agonally. And they call, and the primary nurse isn't in the room because she never got notified. But there's a bunch of nurses because someone stuck their head out the door and said, I need some help. And I had one time where I kept trying to say, you know, what is going on with this? I don't know anything about this person. Who's this patient? Why are they here? Who do they belong to? And nobody knew anything. And finally, this lonely guy in the corner steps up and he was like, oh, I'm with the primary, so I'm the intern. And I guess he was just too scared to speak up. But so, yeah.
Yeah.
And look around and identify, is there anyone here who knows what's going on?
And, you know, the reason it was called is effectively it's like the chief complaint, right, for someone coming to the hospital.
Right.
And as we all know from the ICU, the reason somebody came is not always, doesn't always jive with our sense for what's most important about their picture, but it's still always worth knowing.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to assess the patient and what strikes you the most may be one thing, but do try to know why someone called, because it's possible it was a whole nother thing. And that either may be important to know, you call because you noticed ST elevations. I'm noticing this patient is short of breath, but I should give that some thought. Or at the very least, you should give it attention so that you can acknowledge it in them and, you know, reassure them that is not a big deal. That's okay. I mean, don't downplay it. But, you know, we're acknowledging that, but we're going to, you know, focus on these other things too. Otherwise, someone is, like you said, in the corner being like, yeah, but what about the ST elevation?
Right, right, yeah. You know, and it's worth mentioning that we sometimes lose sight of this because this is our world that we deal with. But if you're not in this world, some of this stuff is very scary. And like you said, somebody may have freaked out about something that we would go, that's not a big deal. Right. And you don't want to make them feel dumb for calling, because I used to say this all the time. The first time that you make someone feel really stupid for calling you is the last time they call you. And then people die, right? Because then when they're scared next time and it is legit, they just say, well, that guy yelled at me last time I called, so I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah, rapid responses are inherently, it's like calling 911. It's sort of a voluntary. I mean, you can make policies on when people should call, but they still have to do it. And for whatever reason, especially I think rapid response teams that are made up of ad hoc teams of people who have other stuff to do, a lot of people's first reaction is to show up and be like, this is dumb.
Like, right, because you want to get back to the stuff that you have to do.
It's
right?
work so to them. So,
yeah, so you're like, why did you call?
So either, this patient is obviously sick. What's wrong with you? Why didn't you do this stuff? Or this patient's obviously fine. This is dumb. And those are all the wrong answers. Because somebody called because they need help. I mean, maybe in an ideal world, they wouldn't have needed help. But they did. So, you know, at best, what you're saying is there can be some kind of more training or something so it doesn't happen next time. This is obviously not the right time for that. But at worst, all you're doing is whining and making people not want to call you anymore.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, it may be a case where it's something that we, because we've seen 50,000 of these, we recognize the go, oh, this is not a big deal. Here's what we'll do. And this person just is new or whatever, or they work in an area where this isn't common. But it may be something that you go, I mean, a floor intern should know this. A floor nurse should know this. I can't believe that you don't know this, but this is not the time. Right?
Yeah, maybe
this is
they
not
should.
The time.
I mean,
it may be that they're dumb. Some people are just dumb, right? It may be that they're dumb, but this is not the time to say, hey, you're dumb, in front of everyone and make them feel bad. you know, work the problem, and then you can pull him aside later and say, let's talk about why, you know, he should have done X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, someone called because they need help. And right. So you don't get to say they didn't need help. Clearly they did. And you got to walk in the room with the mindset of, like, I'm here to help. Whether that's deciding the patient right. is sick or is not sick or fixing their problem or just reassuring everyone. And it can be a kind of a fine line of sending the vibe that, you know, the emergency is over because I'm here, everything is calm, versus there was never any emergency. This is
right.
dumb.
Right.
Well, those are different messages.
Yeah. And if you're upset because you're like, I got stuff to do, I got a bunch of patients in the ICU, and this is not an emergency, well, congratulations, you can get back to your stuff, right? This is not an admit for you, but you don't have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God this patient seems like they're going to be okay.
Right.
I'm going to go. Versus,
yeah, great.
Why did you bother me?
Yeah. Just get back to work. So, yeah. So anyway, you get there and the team's there and they tell you that, you know, this guy was admitted yesterday for just sort of vague complaints. He came in with shortness of breath and eventually it was decided it was a heart failure exacerbation. And today he's had this increasing oxygen requirement. He was originally on 2 liters because he probably just needed room air, but everybody in the hospital seems to be on 2 liters, whether they need it or not. So he's on 2 liters, and throughout the evening and overnight, he's gone up and up, and now he's on 6 liters. And initially, you go, well, I mean, did he need the 6 liters, or was it just because he was satting 95 instead of 100? But you look up, and they've got him hooked up to a pulse ox, and not much else in terms of monitoring, but the pulse ox is up, and he's satting 88 on 6 liters, and he's visibly dyspneic.
You know, in many ways, these scenes are like a pre-hospital scene that you're walking in, getting some, you know, a quick sense from looking at things. But they're unlike it in the sense that you do usually have some other data. So, you know, the patient has already been admitted, although many times very recently admitted. That's a good time for instability to happen. But getting a little bit of information why they're here, like you said, either from people or in almost all cases, we should have some kind of computer that we can pop open, maybe skim the note and look for data. So if we're now starting to formulate differentials saying like, oh, is this heart failure that's worsening? Or what other causes of, you know, acute hypoxic respiratory failure might there be? Something like pneumonia and so on. Of course, that suggests the data that you want and you might need to get that data. Let's say a chest x-ray, and probably we'll order something like that. But maybe one was just done also. So being able to pop open the chart and say, has there been a chest x-ray done recently? Oh, they did one, you know, yesterday, or they did one like an hour ago. These are all things that you probably want to see. They're, you know, recent labs and so on and so forth. But of course, not neglecting the patient too and how they're looking. So in this case, we know that they're hypoxic, although not wildly so. So that's good, I guess. Do we have other vitals?
Yeah, so they just took the blood pressure, and it's, you know, 160 over 90. They don't have a MAP because they just did it with the little portable one. You don't have any kind of EKG because they're not on any kind of monitor for that.
Okay. And is this patient, you said they're having respiratory stress, but they look like there is a great deal of labor. Do they look uncomfortable and tachypneic?
Yeah, they're working kind of hard to breathe. They're short of breath. They can talk to you, but not in complete sentences without having to stop and take a breath. Okay. And yeah, you can see that they're visibly struggling a little bit to breathe.
Okay. What does their skin look like?
They're fairly pale, but dry.
And they're warm peripherally?
Yeah, they feel well perfused, but pale.
Okay. So, I mean, the things that I just rattled through are the things that I would consider kind of the basic struts that support your initial impression of something like this. You know, what is their general mental status and kind of behavior look like? Are they awake? Are they agitated, struggling, sleepy? What is their breathing and their work of breathing look like? And what is their skin like? Is it pale? Is it normal colored? Is it cool and so on? Are they diaphoretic? So, you know, we have here a patient who is clearly dyspneic, but it seems like not wildly unstable. Not so much what I would consider the classic phenotype of, quote, flash pulmonary edema, which is a common reason to kind of suddenly go into hypoxic respiratory failure, which is usually associated with, you know, very high blood pressures and very kind of cool, pale, diaphoretic skin, a very kind of sympathetic, surging patient, but certainly could be in that direction, just not, you know, super acute. And then I rarely these days carry a stethoscope anymore, but these are one of the relatively few kinds of patients where it's probably worth listening to their lungs. Answering on the one hand, is there a bunch of crackles? And I don't know that I can say too much more specific than that, or most people can. Oh, you know, this particular spot or the crackles are finer or coarser, but just in general. And then maybe more importantly, is there wheezing, which will also take you a different direction in terms of differentials. So somebody always has a stethoscope, and I'll probably just ask as someone listened to their lungs, that's the kind of question that I'm looking for.
Yeah, so when you listen to their lungs, you do hear sort of kind of ronchi throughout. They're diminished in the bases. No wheezing, really.
And, you know, in many ways, the wheeze is kind of the one most important thing to detect with a stethoscope, because most other things you can detect with other tools, but there's still no ultrasound mode for wheezing. So, you know, this patient is still hypoxic, so we're clearly going to need to support them in some other way. But it's also, I mean, we don't have to, like, intubate them right now. So you can get some diagnostics rolling. In most cases, a chest x-ray is going to be a good idea, unless it was just done. So one more reason to have a computer, right? You're going to be clicking these things. And if you need to make some calls to facilitate in your workflows, then you want to do that as well. A blood gas will probably be a good idea. In many cases, respiratory therapists may respond with these teams, and someone can poke the patient, although in almost all cases, a venous blood gas, I think, is completely fine. The arterial is just going to add a sense for their oxygenation, which 99% of the time your pulse ox will tell you. The only time when I would like to see a PO2 is if we cannot get any kind of reliable pulse oximetry. But that would be a rare case. So mostly we're asking about their CO2. Are they hypercarbic? In this case, it's looking more like a hypoxic picture, but it would be worth knowing both cases. And then they are hypertensive, which is better than being hypotensive, but is starting to kind of, you know, maybe push me again in that direction of heart failure. Now, you know, skimming the chart and things, we can ask questions like, does this patient's picture seem consistent with other things like pneumonia? But many of these things are not going to be acutely treatable. I mean, it's not like, oh, this patient had pneumonia, quick, get more antibiotics into them. I mean, they're probably already on those.
Cefepime.
Yeah, it's not like a seconds matter kind of thing. If they have pneumonia, we're going to largely support them in the same ways as some other things. But so that's probably what I would do. Now, the question of support will then be, what should we put this person on? And if they're relatively sort of stable looking, there's a good chance that I would try to get the blood gas first. And I say that because that may dictate the modality we want to go to. If they are not hypercarbic, this is purely a matter of oxygenation. That's, their needs are starting to exceed what you can do with like a nasal cannula. Then it could be that a high flow nasal cannula is a good choice. If they are hypercarbic, and maybe it's because there's another process here like COPD, then we may move more towards positive pressure like BiPAP. And if we truly think that this is heart failure, then that's probably also a good reason to go to positive pressure, maybe CPAP, BiPAP, anywhere in that realm. And for that, the x-ray may be helpful. So if they're able to come shoot a film and they really look like they have pulmonary edema, then I'm not going to say it's wrong to do high flow. I mean, there's a little more literature on doing that now. It gives you a bit of a PEEP effect, but it's generally not the treatment of choice. So that would be a better reason to go there as well. If we truly think this was something infectious like pneumonia, then I would probably lean more, again, towards the high flow. If they were really totally failing and they're clearly in a lot of distress, then I would probably not put them on CPAP or BiPAP, except to temporize them before we intubate them. Because generally, that's not a good end stage plan for pneumonia, which is going to take days to get better, and we're probably not going to want to leave them with a mask on for days. Mm-hmm. But if they're kind of just a little hypoxic, maybe it's a bit of pneumonia, then high flow is a nice choice. So the reason I mentioned the diagnostics is because, for example, a blood gas, not so much, you know, the ventilatory support, but especially the gas, you'd probably like to have it before you start to mess with your data by maybe strapping a mask on their face and so on. Now, if they're you know, failing in front of you, you got to treat before you diagnose. That's fine, but that doesn't sound like this person.
Yeah. So, all right. So you get in, your RT's there, and they stick and get an ABG for you, and the rapid nurse has a little point of care machine. So runs a gas, and your gas is reasonably normal, like what you would expect. pH is okay. PO2 is low, as sort of you would guess based on the pulse ox. CO2 is borderline high, kind of high normal. And otherwise fairly unremarkable. Lactate's normal.
And then have you had a recent x-ray, or were you able to get one?
So x-ray comes and they shoot one, and it is just gross looking. It's just white opacities all over the place, both sides. You can't appreciate any specific focal consolidation, but just sort of diffuse opacities throughout the field, long fields.
Yeah. Now, you know, there is this sort of spectrum, but certainly this is sounding more like that heart failure sort of person. And if it was a big change, like maybe they had another prior film earlier today and it wasn't as bad, then it probably is mediated by changes in loading conditions, the sort of thing we talk about with this flash pulmonary edema picture. Something made them spike their blood pressure, vasoconstrict peripherally. Their heart was like, I can't handle that extra afterload. Fluid backed up into their lungs, and then that made them more distressed. They vasoconstricted more, and so on. But of course, maybe they came in with a bit of this and they were just overloaded and so on. I will say that, by the way, if x-ray is taking longer, ultrasound can be a nice tool in these people. We have a little rapid response bag, which has a handheld ultrasound. And I have actually my own little butterfly that I have in a little fanny pack. And while I would not say I'm a big user of lung ultrasound, doing a quick peek to look for the presence of B lines is a very easy study. We're not looking for anything focal in someone like this. We're just skimming the anterior chest. And if you see B lines all over the place, very diffusely, it's a great support for a diagnosis like pulmonary edema. If you start to look for focal things like pneumonia, that's already getting out of what I care to do. We can x-ray them. And you can look for stuff like lung sliding to rule out a pneumothorax, but that's pretty low yield unless this is a person who is likely to have that, which is more in other realms like surgical realms and stuff like that. But so, you know, with data like that, I would lean towards a modality like CPAP. If someone wants to do BiPAP with a relatively small driving pressure, that's fine too. But something like CPAP of like 8 or 10 or BiPAP like 12 over 8 or something like that might be where I would start. Because this is a good tool for treating pulmonary edema. They're not particularly hypercarbic, so they don't need a ton of support ventilating. They mostly need the PEEP effect. And could someone like this do okay with, let's say, high flow? I mean, it's possible. It gives them a bit of PEEP. It gives them more oxygen. And if there was a reason you couldn't use positive pressure, like some patients won't tolerate a mask, things like that, then you could. But the first line is generally non-invasive positive pressure. So that's what I would probably ask for. And then the second question is usually, now what? Because now you've kind of attached a rescue device to this patient's face to help them breathe. And in many places, that means they can't stay on a regular floor bed. So it may require transfer to the ICU or some kind of intermediate step-down unit if you can do that. This is something to work out with your teams, and it depends on your local policies. And a great deal of it depends on local comfort. So dispo should always be a question at these scenes, and hopefully you have your primary teams there and the primary nurses, and many times also people from other places like the ICU will turn up, and you can decide, is this a patient you can stay where they are, or does their general presentation, and particularly the things that we've done now, maybe we've put them on a pressor or on BiPAP or something else, does that require them to go to a particular place? Because many times there's just rules. Oh, rescue, BiPAP, they have to go to the ICU or something like that.
Yeah, and I think you made a really important point when you say comfort level, because I get this a lot from students, like, well, who should go to the ICU and who can go to this place? And it just varies so much, right? If you have, we get patients all the time that come from these small hospitals who are in an ICU, and they get there and we go, well, this patient doesn't need to be in the ICU, right? We would put them on the progressive unit where we are. but we're a level one trauma center, an academic referral center. You know, we have 100+ ICU beds in our hospital. The stuff that we're comfortable with on the floor is not going to be comfortable everywhere. And, you know, so I think that has to be taken into consideration. The other thing is I will get calls sometimes, again, usually this come from like urology maybe, right? Or so, some surgical service who rarely puts people in the ICU. And when they do, they sort of are like, can you guys just take over and manage things? Cause we don't really know much about this sort of thing. They'll call and say, I think this patient needs to come to the ICU. You go look at them and go, I don't think they do, right? There's really not anything that we're going to do differently. But you sit and have a conversation and it says like, I think you're fine. I think everything you're doing is right and this patient is in good hands. But if you're not comfortable, I'll take them to the ICU. And I think sometimes that even though we might go, like getting back to the why did you call me in the first place, this is not something that needs to go to the ICU. There's not a policy that says they have to go to the ICU. It's just the team is nervous. And that's okay. I think that's okay to say, if you're uncomfortable with this and you're nervous about this, we will take them to the ICU.
Yeah, and you really do have to have an open mind to what you're hearing from the teams on the, quote, lesser levels of care. Because someone may say, oh, like, I think they can stay here. We're not real comfortable with that. And your reaction may be like, what does that even mean, man? Like, hey, I'm never comfortable. Life is tough. But what they're saying is that there's something missing in their milieu, which makes it difficult to, you know, confidently care for this person. And it may be their level of experience or training. And it may be things just like their staffing. Like,
yeah,
it's hard for us to imagine these other settings sometimes, but, you know, a patient where you may not be doing much, but you're going to be, you know, frequently checking in on them. They'll have a nurse who only has one other patient. You have whatever, a handful of other patients, but you're always in the area and you could respond at any time to do more things. None of that may be true in these other settings. The nurse may have 5 other patients. Their team may have 20 other patients and is nowhere nearby. So the mere fact that, like, if when you walk out of the room, there may be no one to, like, lay eyes on this patient for a while, that alone may not be enough for this person. And it may very well mean that in many cases, people, you know, you don't need to go home, but you can't stay here. Like, they don't need the ICU, but they can't be in this place. And unfortunately, that means they need the ICU because you need to default to, you know, the adequate level of care. And that's why, you know, in-betweeny intermediate sorts of units exist, but you could always fall between these categories. But it's, once again, it's very hard for you to say someone else doesn't need help or is comfortable when they're not, because it's not your decision to make.
Yeah, and sometimes having a conversation like, well, so why are you uncomfortable? Tell me what's the problem? Because sometimes you can just reassure people. Maybe they're like, well, I'm afraid of X. And you go, oh, okay, well, that's not going to happen. And here's why. Or if it happens, here's what you do. Or like if this happens or this happens, set some parameters, right? I don't think they need to come to the ICU, but if X, Y, and Z happens, call me and I will come right back. And like you said, sometimes it's staffing. I get that a lot. You know, we take call from home at night and there's nobody in house, or even worse, right? We take call from home, but there's an intern in house and the intern has 40 patients and has no support. So sometimes that may be okay, hey, I get it. Tell your intern, give your intern my phone number. He can call me if he has questions and I'm happy to come help him. I think he can do this, or we'll just take the patient to make everybody's life easier.
Yeah, you know, a little while ago, I got called by the gynecology service who had a post-op patient who was very hypertensive, like over 200 systolic. And they're like, we think this person needs to come to the ICU for like an nicardipine drip or something to lower their blood pressure. And we talked and it became clear this patient had no other symptoms or signs of end organ damage. It was just hypertension, and they always had been. It was a little bit higher now. And so then we were kind of discussing what we would do and sort of trying to lay out that, you know, the data and the guidelines suggest there's not really any high blood pressure that needs to be lowered in, you know, inpatients if there's not causing a problem. Maybe you do nothing, or at the most start them on some new oral agents or something. So we could bring this person to the ICU, and we're willing to if it has to happen. But what I would probably do with them is nothing. And so, you know, that would be a bit of a disservice to this otherwise stable person who's almost ready to go home. So then it's like, well, what can we do? Maybe you can have a bit of PRNs and, you know, discuss with maybe cardiology. They can suggest escalating the oral regimen and so on and so forth. So it's kind of sharing information and expertise and what you do and can do in your setting versus what other people can do, because everyone knows their thing, but not much else. But I think the most important thing is just having an open mind and amicable discussion about it, not one that is being couched in either judgment or like work avoidance. Like some people clearly are just bending over backwards to avoid like bringing people onto their service. Mm-hmm. And I will say, just practically speaking, well, everywhere is different. If you have a patient where, you know, sure, you have a conversation, everyone's like, that's fine, that's cool. But if people really are like, oh, I don't think they can stay here, and you're like, oh, I think they can, and you manage to avoid bringing them to the ICU or otherwise upgrading them, most of them end up in the ICU later. Not much later. Yeah. In an hour or two, because they get a little worse, something changes. So, like, you're not avoiding anything. Just like admit that patient if that's what has to happen. It is rare that borderline people ever manage to like stay out of trouble for very long.
Yeah, and I'll say this is something I teach new folks a lot when we talk about moving people out of the ICU, right? You call the primary service or the service that's going to be taking them on the floor or whatever, and you say, hey, I think this person's ready to downgrade, and they go, I don't think so. I think we want to keep them in the ICU another day. So how much do you push, right? And my feeling is, if I push and something happens, then not only have I potentially harmed a patient, right, because I pushed them out of the ICU before they're ready, but more importantly, probably because honestly, they're probably not going to get harmed, right? But if anything happens, then I've damaged my relationship with that team and my reputation with that team. And the same thing kind of here, right? You go, this patient does not need to come to the ICU. They're fine. And 6 hours later, they really crump. Then it looks like you don't know what you're doing, right? And so then that team goes, God, the ICU team doesn't even know what they're doing. How can I trust them? So I think you're right. And if you've got somebody who's borderline and you think they're fine, but the other team's pushing back a lot, I think it's better sometimes just to say, you know what? You're uncomfortable. The patient's kind of borderline. We'll take them versus drawing a hard line in the sand and saying, we're going to fight about this because eventually something will happen, even if it's not a big deal, that will prove, at least in their minds, that you're wrong and they're right.
Yeah. Like any escalations in care, a significant number of people who go to, let's say, the ICU because of a concerning issue will not end up needing whatever you're considering. They won't need to be intubated. They might not end up on pressors or whatever it may be. But you can't have it perfect. If you try to make sure everyone who goes to the ICU needs a bunch of care, you're going to leave a bunch of people outside the ICU who should have had it. Because the only alternative is, you know, some amount of over-triage is needed, mm-hmm. if that's the word. And the place to assess that and follow it and be able to rapidly act is in that setting, not in the setting of lesser care. So the other side of this is that if you end up not just taking the patient over, and this is if you're from the ICU, of course. If you're a separate team and you're sending them elsewhere, it's sort of the same matter. But if you end up leaving them in their current situation, it's essential to have like a rational conversation and plan about that. So whoever is going to keep the patient, you need to talk about it, make sure that they are comfortable with that and have a plan for it. Meaning you don't just go, I think this patient's fine, and you like peace out. Because right. Then you have not done anything to manage the situation.
Then we're back to the jerk who showed up and said,
well, yeah, and whatever.
Why'd you bug me?
You were called because there was a gap or a deficit in comfort or knowledge or whatever, and that's still present. You haven't fixed
right.
that.
You haven't fixed it.
you know, figure out like, you know, here's what I think. Here's what I think we should do. And here's the path going forward that I would suggest, and that would mean doing this, follow this test, assess this, see how this goes, how it trends, whatever, for this amount of time and so on. And then if that's fine, that's fine. And if this, you know, goes wrong, you know, call back or call the ICU or whatever, and then they should probably go there then. And then make sure everyone is okay with that plan. Because it may be that what you suggested was like, we can't do that for whatever reason.
Right.
But it needs to be two ways. You can't just be like, I'm out of here. Because again, you haven't. And it's just so easy for responders to show up and then just leave without addressing the issues. And this gets back to the original, like, why were we called? And it may be that the original concern or a current one is not your primary concern. You're focusing on this other thing, but someone's like, okay, what are we going to do about this like agitated patient who keeps climbing out of bed? It's like a right. practical matter, you know, things that may be more about like nursing or location or stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, that would be how I would tackle something like this. And this would be a, you know, a quite common situation. And, you know, the times when these things happen are often shortly after admission or shortly after, you know, downgrades from the ICU or other changes like that. And it should not be unexpected. You know, expect that some patients will get better just as they get worse. And it shouldn't be unexpected or some kind of thing you have to convince yourself is happening for a patient to become more ill on the floor and need a rapid response and maybe need to be upgraded in care. That's why these systems are in place. Mm-hmm. So you were called, this patient is more ill, you have to do more stuff, do it. Great. The system worked. What was not supposed to happen was a patient like codes on the floor because no one was doing stuff to them. You know, thank God you're here and you did stuff and then you go from there.
Yeah. All right. So you're going to move this guy to the ICU, right? So
we put him on, you know, non-invasive, see if there's other things we need to do like diuresis and stuff. I'd probably echo them and so on. Where they need to land will depend on, you know, your center. For us, in most cases, it would probably be the ICU. Many places could probably take them in some sort of a step-down unit depending on, you know, local comfort. He's not so ill that I would say he medically must be in the ICU, but it should certainly be wherever they are on a kind of short time scale of reassessing and seeing how they're doing, because they should turn around pretty quickly. If they're like still marinating on CPAP, BiPAP, you know, next shift, this is kind of stretching.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Well, so let's say you decide, okay, yeah, he needs to be in the ICU. The people on the floor are not comfortable with this anymore. You give him some Lasix, you put him on some BiPAP, and you put in transfer orders. And so that's that. Are you good? You going back to the unit now? Or?
So depending on if they're going right now, I may go down with them, you know, accompany them, depending on how ill they are, or maybe go right ahead of them and meet them down there. Some of that depends on kind of how stable they are. If they're kind of stable-ish, it's sometimes nice to go ahead and then kind of get some things situated and throw some orders in and stuff like that. And again, always good to have a conversation with the primary team to close loops. I don't always need someone to, let's say, write a transfer note or something, but at least you can have a conversation about, you know, the patient and make sure you have a full picture. Because, you know, you just breezed in here, you may be working on a kind of quick partial sense for what their deal is. Not big picture stuff like, let's say, code status. You know, where were they in their sort of general goals of care? Was that conversations been had? Or maybe their acute issues related to some other chronic illness and they have more information about that, stuff like that.
Okay. So the nurse tells you that there's not a bed ready in the ICU right now. But they'll get them transferred at some point. How do you feel about that?
So this is tough because, you know, you do need close follow-up, and who can do that may not be so important, but it should be someone. So it may just be a matter of like having a conversation, like, you know, with the nurse, how closely are they going to be able to watch this person, or, you know, their current primary team, or, you know, some rapid response and similar services have people who like they do this, they do like follow-ups and like follow people on the floor, which is great because that is an important part of this. Many times you need to transfer someone just so you can do that. But if you can do it in their current floor, then maybe they can stay. And if it really is someone who just needs to be watched so closely and can't go anywhere, then maybe I need to stay with them at least for a while or, you know, frequently come back and check, something like that. Mm-hmm. That would be uncommon, you know, for me in my current world. But, you know, if that's what it takes to not like abandon this person, then it may be necessary. Because then it's essentially, in a way, your patient now. They're just outside the ICU.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that matters a lot with this is something kind of we've touched on a little bit with all aspects of this, in that you're working with a team that is not your normal team, right? You probably don't know this nurse. Maybe you do. Maybe you go to this floor frequently and you've kind of gotten to know people, but likely you don't, not to the degree that you know your ICU team, right? And so my ICU, I know the nurses, and I know that, you know, if I have a patient that needs this and that so-and-so is going to be able to take care of that. If I don't know this nurse, maybe they're going to be fine, right? Maybe they're like, listen, I've been a nurse for a long time. I feel really comfortable with this. They're going to check in on them frequently. Maybe there's somebody who's just kind of overwhelmed and they're going to be like, okay, the ICU team did some stuff to this guy and they're going to take him and I got to go do other things. And they never go back and look at him until there's trouble again. So I think that's something you have to kind of assess. And it's tricky because you don't know these people. You don't know what all is going to happen.
Yeah, and a lot of it may not even be about who has time or who has the skill set, but who is like who is making it their problem versus washing their hands of it. And if it's a situation where, you know, maybe you went to a rapid, patient was fine, you left, that patient is off my radar. I am no longer thinking about that.
Correct.
But it should be on someone's radar because it's still a patient. And a patient like this, it just needs to be maybe it's the nurse or respiratory therapist or me. Someone needs to be making sure they check on this patient, make sure they're okay, because the other people very possibly are not. They're doing other things. So who is going to own this issue?
Yeah, and that's a good point because I think a lot of times, you know, like we said, the floor team has a bunch of stuff going on. And they go, great, the ICU's involved. I can kind of step away and go see my other people. But if you're not, that you're not involved at this point, right? You're, like you said, you've gone back to the unit. They're kind of off your radar until they show up. I think just having a conversation to make sure that you establish that, like, hey, I'm going to go back to the unit. You guys need to keep a close eye on this patient. And if X, Y, and Z happens, call me back. Okay, I guess I'm going to stay, right? Just make sure that because I think what happens is everyone assumes someone else is doing it.
Right.
Right. It's just like in ACLS when you're supposed to say you and point to somebody, go get the AED. Because if you just say somebody get the AED, everybody's going to assume someone else is doing it.
Yeah,
and I think this is the same thing.
Responsibility.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to make your plans while you're in the room with these other people. Because the whole point of the rapid response is to physically get everyone involved together at one time, so that you can do things that need to be done. As soon as people start leaving, you're never going to see them again. And then to communicate with any of them is going to be really hard. You're going to have to figure out who to call or page, and you're not going to be able to get them all together. So now is the time. It's like you know, when you're rounding and you have a discussion about something and then you just wander off without making a decision. That's not what you want here. Make the decision. Don't just talk about it. Whatever the decision is, and make the plan now while everyone's here. Make sure it's understood. And then you can start percolating away. People who have no role in this will never be seen again. People who have a plan should execute that plan. But don't think you can like sort it out later. There is no later. People are going to go do other things, go to the next problem, and forget about it.
I think another thing that's important to mention here is to have a conversation with the patient's family. Maybe there's family in the room. Maybe there's not. Right? Again, you can defer this to their admitting service, but I think it's something that you have to have a conversation about, because I've had times before where, you know, patients' family show up hours later and have no idea that they went to the ICU. They go to their room and there's somebody else in the room. And, well, what happened to my dad? Where is he? Right? Because nobody thought to call, because the admitting team thought the ICU team would call, and the ICU team thought, well, the admitting team knows him. They'll call. So again, I think it's just important to have a conversation. I don't think it necessarily matters in every case who calls. Now, sometimes it does. Like if you're intubating this patient and doing a lot to them, then I think that's kind of on you to call and say, here's what we're doing, as opposed to the patient who you say, fine, we'll take them to the ICU just because you're uncomfortable, but we're not really going to do that much. Then I don't think it matters if the admitting team calls.
Yeah, and families hate when people like went to the ICU and no one called them. But also, you know, the patient, by the way, maybe talk to them if they're awake.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
Tell them what's going on. Because yeah. All this like fuss is like, it's like scary. People will or the families will think that someone is like straight up dying. And of course, maybe they are. But once you figure out a plan and stuff, talk to them and be like, this is what we're thinking, you know, we're worried or we're not. And especially if it's to reassure them, be like, someone, you know, this was a little odd looking, so we all came to assess, but I think we're good. You know, we're not too worried about it. And this is, because otherwise, by default, everyone's going to assume this is like a crisis. And they may be keeping it together while you do your thing, but, you know, especially the poor patients, they're all just like lying there, like all these people buzzing around them, talking about like this and that. And they're like, what's going on, guys?
Yeah. Well, we tend to, you know, showing up and this is our world, this is what we do, but the floor people maybe are confused or anxious because it's not their norm. The patient and their family, it's really not their norm, right? Like, they don't know anything about this in most cases. And so, yeah, reassure them. The other thing to consider is if you and the admitting service or you and the floor nurse or whatever have vastly different opinions of the severity of things, you know, it's a good chance that that patient knows them better than they, you're some stranger who walked in, right? So you can't come in and be like, well, you know, your doctor jumped the gun and, you know, you're not that sick, because they're not going to believe you. They're going to believe him. He's the guy that they go to all the time, right? So I think you have to go in and say, you know, have a conversation that doesn't make it look like, you know, well, he's wrong and I'm right. And
yeah, I think it's very helpful. Once you have sort of a sense for things and maybe a bit of a plan to talk to the room, to everyone involved, and summarize, you know, what your sense is, what you think is happening, and what you think should be done. Because a lot of this otherwise is going on in your head or is kind of implicit or maybe some like various side conversations. But just to bring it all together, because there are going to be a lot of people in here who do not know what's going on. Either they don't have quite the acumen with this sort of thing, or they just don't know what you're thinking. They may be smart people, but you're like not talking. So they're trying to guess, like, what are you worried about? What are you trying to treat? To say like, look, you know, this looks like maybe worsening of congestive heart failure. It is possible there could be, you know, an element of COPD or pneumonia or something as well. But this makes the most sense. So, you know, we're on more oxygen. The next step is probably to go to BiPAP. That should help a lot with the work of breathing and oxygenation. And we can give a bit of Lasix as well. And we just need to closely follow up to make sure that we're getting better in the next hour or two. Because if not, then the next step could be intubation. So maybe this patient will need to go to the ICU, or, you know, what are we thinking? Can we do this sort of follow-up here? And you could have these conversations. But making things explicit is more important in these ad hoc teams, including some non-critical care people, than even in the ICU, where I would say it is also important, because mm-hmm. no one knows what you're thinking.
Yeah, and especially when you're talking to patients and families, I think it's good, and it's a fine line to walk, right? But to inform them of what might happen next, right? Because what you don't want is, everything's fine. You're doing great. We're going to just put you in the ICU because everybody's nervous. And then 30 minutes later, you're intubating somebody. And they're all, where'd that come from, right? But at the same time, you don't want to overly scare people and be like, hey, we're going to move you to the ICU because I think we're probably going to have to put you on the breathing machine. So it's a very fine line to walk, but with keeping people informed versus scaring them.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little while ago also. When you communicate with families, and especially if they're not present, you're calling them, the right time, I think, is when you have a sense for what's happening and you have a plan for it, because you want to let them know what's going on. But too early, and you're it's like they're part of your team. You're like, well, we'll see what the CO2 is. Okay, well, the CO2, they're like, what does all this mean?
Right.
And what I would especially not do is call to sort of ask their permission for things, which I see not infrequently. If you're considering doing something like bringing them to the ICU, putting them on pressors, intubating them, to like ask if they want that. Maybe an older person who's sicker and they're like, well, you know, do you want to escalate in this way? I don't think anyone can have a rational decision about goals of care in this setting. The time to have that conversation was before this happened.
Yeah.
So if right now their code status is to do CPR and intubate them, do it.
That's what you're doing.
Don't call and be like, your brother can't breathe. Should we put a breathing tube in? If that's what they decided.
Yeah.
Now, if after doing so, you guys want to have a more thoughtful conversation in days to come about, do you want to keep this? Do you ever want to do it again? And so on, in light of this decompensation, that's a great idea. But this is not the time. Do whatever the plan has been to do, because they can't make a good decision right now. I would almost say that any decision made right now is likely to be the wrong one. It's under duress.
Yeah, I always tell folks, there's very little we do in the ICU that can't be undone, right? We intubate you and things aren't looking good and you're going to have a trach and you don't want that. We don't have to trach you, right? We can extubate you and make you comfortable. But if there's any question in the moment, I think we do everything. And that goes for CPR for that matter too, right? If you arrest and need CPR, that's not the time to be like, hey, their heart stopped. Do you, you sure you want the CPR? Right, you just do the CPR. And if they decide later, I don't want that, you know, when you're on your fifth round of ACLS and not getting ROSC, then you can say stop. Or if you get ROSC, then you can say, well, that would sucked and we don't want to do that again. So let's make them DNR for the future. But I agree with you. That's, this is not the time to make those decisions.
Yeah, the one exception would be someone where there's been a lot of active conversations about end of life, and they're really they are kind of just about there in terms of like limiting what you want to do, and there was just a sort of a timing thing, and but you really you don't think they want to do certain things, you just hadn't fully made that move yet, and maybe this will kind of be like, oh, like now is actually the time. Or you have people in the ICU sometimes where you're like, their family really probably wants to make them like, you know, CMO, you know, maybe, you know, withdraw things. But they were just, oh, we were going to wait it like a day. Maybe a family member is going to come visit. Some kind of, today was our birthday. We don't want something like that. Oh, yeah. But now the patient is like peri-arrest. And you're like, hey, listen, technically we should be about to do CPR. Do you really want to do that? And they're like, oh, no. They just, that kind of, that's one thing.
That's a different scenario.
Yeah. But if you, you know, if you hadn't even gotten, you know, oh, they have cancer and you're like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do a lot of stuff, but you're nowhere near that. This is not the time. You're not going to make it happen in the next 5 seconds.
Yeah. And along those lines, something that we probably should have addressed when we first started this scenario is when you arrive on the scene, you should verify what their code status is, because I've gotten those calls before where you get there and they're DNR, DNI, they don't want anything. But you've got some resident who's cross covering or a nurse who doesn't know what their wishes are and they call, you know, for help. You want to know kind of going in, like, well, what's okay for me to do, right? Because you go, hey, this person needs to be intubated, and you intubate him. And then when the family shows up, they go, he was DNR. Why did you intubate him? Because I never asked, right? Yeah, and no one ever told. I was waiting for someone.
Those people.
I was waiting for someone to tell me, and no one did, so I just did it, right? That's a bad
It should be the responsibility of the patient's nurse to share that stuff, but, you know, always good to verify as well, especially if you're, you know, building plans in your head, and it may involve things that are actually not on the table.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's a good place to wrap it up, you know, because the ultimately, this case is really not about treating this guy's heart failure. We've done plenty of those. This is about dealing with the out of ICU quasi emergency. So, any thoughts before we close up?
No, like you said, a lot of it is not so much the medicine; it's the environment. In a way, you're treating the not so much just the patient as the room, the current team of providers and nurses and everyone else. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, they're fact. It's like, you know, I don't know, fixing your car versus fixing your car in a rainstorm with no tools. I mean, those variables are real things. It's no one's fault or anything. It's just part of the picture. So in many ways, that's your role and your goal to establish control and calm and a sense for what's happening and to make a plan. And just like the Joker, almost any plan is better than no plan. Everyone will feel much better, even if your plan is to set the room on fire. and to make sure that you're you know, closing the loop so that you come in, figure out what's happening, and then when you leave, everyone knows what's happening next as well, in a way that involves everyone and is supportive of everyone. Again, seeing your role as helping, meaning the patient, the team, no matter what that may mean. It may mean reassurance. It may mean acute treatments. It may mean moving the patient. If you come from that perspective, and then, of course, you bring your critical care skill set, then it's going to work out. If you don't have knowledge, but more importantly, don't have an attitude that you're here to help, that's how these things turn into weird confrontational situations.
These are just our thoughts, right? This is for educational use, shouldn't be construed as medical advice, and we don't represent any of our respective institutions, just our own thoughts. So thanks, and we'll see you next time.